You're listening to Why We Do What We Do. Welcome to Why We Do What We Do. I am your laboring host, Abraham.
And I am your forgetting to take vacation host, Shane.
Oh, don't do that. It's terrible.
I know. It only benefits the company.
Right? We are a psychology podcast, ostensibly. And we're also like a comedy science edutainment type podcast. We are both people who were trained in psychology. We came up that way. So if you're joining us for the first time, welcome. If you like what you hear today and would like to support the show, you can always subscribe, leave a rating and review, join us on Patreon, buy some merch, do that stuff. We'll talk about it more at the end.
Yeah.
All right. Shane, what are we talking about today?
Today, we're talking about the 40-hour work week, something that is pretty, I would say, standard practice in the United States. And we'll talk about some of that stuff, too. But yes, we're talking about working 40 hours in a week.
Yeah. And I mean, sort of loosely, this is a capitalism episode because I think those two just go hand in hand. You know,
oh, of course.
Yeah. We're talking about this labor sort of thing. And it got me thinking, this was mentioned on some of the podcasts, just this, like, oh, you know, this 40-hour work week. And I was like, yeah, but where does a 40-hour work week come from? Mm-hmm. That tradition had to get started somewhere. Like, that's now essentially legal as the legal framework for a work week in the United States with certain parameters around that. That's not true in other countries.
Nope.
Right. And so I just kind of wanted to know why 40 hours? Where did that come from?
I think it's a fair question. I mean, we are all involved in that system. And it seems like that 40-hour work week system is applied to every field on some level. You might see different variations and stuff. And we'll kind of talk a little bit about that too. But for the most part, yeah, we're all kind of like embedded in this, like, you know, post-capitalism 40-hour work week kind of like standard. And it is worth kind of knowing how that even got started to begin with.
Yeah. And I was kind of curious what other work schedules are out there. And then also, and obviously for a psychology podcast, how does the 40-hour work week impact us?
Yeah.
Right? Does this work for us? Is this like psychologically healthy to do? Is it not? Are other schedules better or worse? What does it mean for the company, for the business to have that work week, that sort of thing? So I figured we should just dig into it.
As we do with all of our topics, we want to provide a little bit of background. So in order to understand what a 40-hour work week is, we have to first understand what is a week. So don't stress. We're not going to send you into some kind of existential crisis trying to figure out time and understand time and all that. Like, we're not doing that. Like, we know that time is a construct. Da, da, da. So anyway, so what is a week? There's actually nothing naturally that corresponds with segmenting days into 7-day chunks. There's nothing that we would reference to be like, okay, like, you know, seasons happen in 7-day work, weeks or whatever.
Yeah,
there's nothing.
Right?
There's nothing that suggests that we should be having 7-day weeks.
Yeah, there's sort of loosely a 30-day cycle because of the moon that we have that we could follow.
Right.
But there's no reason necessarily to separate time into 7 days as a unit that we would call something meaningful, right?
Right.
So yes, put that in your pipe and smoke it on your way to work
while you're listening to this. Take that, Father Time.
And actually, other week lengths have been used in other calendars. I was curious because obviously, like, we landed on 7 for a reason, but what else has there been? The Egyptians, I found, for example, used a 10-day week, which would work just fine as well.
Yeah.
And I think that as we're talking about how this impacts us, how we think about things, how we orient to time, the concept of a week is essentially foundational to how we think about planning and particularly where we are in time relation to other things that are going to happen. And it's just the same sort of measurements that we take, like a yard or a meter in physical space, right, is an arbitrary distance. We decided it was a useful one. And a week is kind of similar. Like, it's an arbitrary length that we decided was meaningful to break up in that way. And so it could be broken up in many of those, but it really dramatically affects then how we think about when we're moving forward, what's happening at this point. When do we start event A, whatever that might be? And even thinking way back before we had party planning and that sort of thing, you know, back when our main concern was, are we going to be able to feed ourselves and the people in our community, our traveling nomad community, whatever that might be.
Right.
Because even then you might think like, okay, we have about this much time until the season begins or ends, you know, whatever, when, and we'll be able to store this food for this amount of time and being able to say like, this is going to be good for chunks, whatever that might be, meant that those chunks had to have some kind of name and value associated with them. So I don't know. It's just kind of a thought experiment there.
But also, that's just beyond our scope. Like, today, we're not doing that right now.
The whole diatribe I just did.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's good. It's good. But it's like, it was one of those things where it's like, we can't do this today. Like, I'm not in a mental place to do that today, or an emotional place to do that today. So, like, I can't undo the trappings of time right now. What we should say, though, is we've kind of settled on this, right? Like, we've settled on a 7-day week, 160 hours in a week, 112 waking hours if you assume 8 hours of sleep, which I think both of us could, that's one of our birthday wishes.
Yeah. Yeah. One please day. 8 hours of sleep.
Please,
maybe.
Please. If you're curious about why we talk about that, you should go back and listen to all of our sleep episodes, because apparently that's right. The big series that we did.
It's kind of a theme with us, and probably because we're so chronically deprived of it.
It's in strength in our repertoires and we notice that it comes up almost every week.
Right. Yeah. In some capacity.
Yeah.
All right. Now, if you think about, as I said, this is related very strongly to the idea of capitalism. And the reason being that we're talking about work week, right? And you're not working unless you're working usually to make some kind of money. Mm-hmm. But if we actually go back a little bit, there was a lot of people working on farms. When we started agriculture, then it meant that we're people who are essentially dedicated to just growing food is sort of what they're doing. And obviously those people still exist.
Right, farmers. Of course.
And all that's great. And we're super appreciative of that. But work that was not industrial farming, and this was just basic work to live and support your family and support your community, this was easily 12 to 13 hours per day. So we're talking 84 to 91 hours per week of work that they're doing. And this is not necessarily, on a capitalist system. And it's not like a clock in, clock out sort of thing. This is necessary work that has to happen. And so it, in some cultures, obviously it was a little bit communal, but essentially the thing being that this was tons and tons of nonstop work.
Yeah. Now, during the Industrial Revolution, we started seeing this kind of become the standard, right? So from 80 to 100 hour work weeks were regular work weeks. And so for those of you who are behavior analysts, you're like, I get it. You might be one of those people that works too much. I could do an 80 hour work week and not even think twice about it because I actually really like what I do, but I've had to learn to draw some lines. But in 1817, labor activists and unions advocated for better work conditions and better hours. So you started to kind of see a shift away from that 80 to 100 work hour a week from these advocates that were saying, hey, this is not good for us. This is actually very bad for us.
Yeah, so particularly when you start getting into factories, they're often really dangerous jobs. You're around a lot of chemicals. You're inside most of the day. It doesn't inspire a lot of any socialization, that sort of thing. Very few breaks, that sort of thing. So
right.
That was 1817. Now we're into 1866. A national labor union attempted to get Congress in the United States to approve 8-hour workdays, which would be a pretty radical transformation down from the 12 to 13 they're working sometimes. Congress did not pass it, but what it did is it increased public awareness and support for the idea of an 8-hour work week. And actually, that reminded me, one of the other things that got me thinking about this was, as the pandemic got into full swing and everyone sort of went into lockdown, and some companies started trying these like 4-day work weeks. Mm-hmm. And so that was sort of an interesting thing, like concept to think about. And so this was kind of a similar idea back in 1866, is this idea of like, we don't need to work these 12-hour days. Let's work 8-hour days instead. And this, like, let's just cap it. Let's scale this back so we can have lives.
This is something that you see kind of time and time again, right? And I think this is the importance of bringing stuff into the public eye and having those discussions, even if it doesn't pass right away, right? So this is 1866, where this goes to Congress, it doesn't work. But in 1869, Ulysses S. Grant actually approved 8-hour workdays for federal employees. So it started on this federal level, and this made it more likely that the private sector would start to adopt similar practices. Because think about it like this. You're a federal employee, you're working 8 hours. Your neighbor who is working in a private sector is working 15 hours in a day, and they're like, ooh, that federal job sounds pretty, pretty good right now. And you start kind of seeing a shift in the public acceptance of longer work hours. And they go, I don't like this anymore. I like this 8-hour day. It sounds cool. And then you start kind of seeing that culture shift around this.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So that's why it's such an important feature when those things happen, that they can sort of drive change in a particular direction, mm-hmm. be it good or bad, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So that was 1869. 5 years later, we get the first actual bill in a state that passes. This is 1874. Massachusetts passed the first 10-hour workday law that was enforceable, because there had been some other attempts to pass versions of a law like that. And now this is no longer just federal employees. Now we're talking about as a business in Massachusetts, 10 hours was your max.
Yeah. I haven't seen this yet, but I would love for anybody in Massachusetts to produce a law where natives of the state have to add R's to their words. This has not happened yet.
That would be chaos.
So you have a bunch of hard workers. Yeah. So, which is great, but you know, there's some more important things I would say. So,
how would you be able to tell where they were from if they started pronouncing their R's?
You're right. That's fair. You're not wrong. I guess that is like a regional thing, but also a hard R every now and again. Just using R's in your words might be a good thing.
Yeah. So that's fair.
Yeah. Now, 1879, the first published use of the term weekend appeared in a British magazine of all places. So that's fun. Notes and Queries. Very, very British name at that. I also very much so love that America was like, your tea sucks, and then dumped it all into the harbor. And then now we're going and we're like, actually, weekend sounds very nice.
Yeah.
We're going to go ahead and take that. Thank you. Now, the quote was, quote, if a person leaves home at the end of his week's work on the Saturday afternoon to spend the evening of Saturday and the following Sunday with friends at a distance, he is said to be spending his weekend at so-and-so, end quote.
Which is kind of crazy to think that we didn't have a term for not working until then.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It was just, you're working all the time. And they're like, but what about when the week ends? And they're like, weekend? Like, yeah, your strength is low. You're weakened.
Yeah. And they're like, no, weekend, end of a week. Yeah. And they're like, what does that mean? There was no end of the week.
Yeah. Sounds like you're trying to take my money.
Yeah. Yeah, Scrooge is pissed.
That's right. In 1886, or 7 years down the road from the term weekend now, Illinois, the state in the U.S., passed a law mandating an eight-hour work week. So we're getting closer now. Mm-hmm. However, when employers refused to comply, this led to the Haymarket Riot, where employees rebelled against their employers and 12 people died. I actually read, there was like a big story account of this. There was like bombs and all kinds of killings and some craziness going on. And this is wild. Just to frame this in context, right? This is people saying, we want to work only 8 hours a day at a time. And now the business can stay open as long as they want, as long as they're not forcing their employees to work more than 8 hours at a time.
Right.
And they're already on like 12-hour days. So they're asking essentially for like a 33% reduction in their time. And the company was like, I would rather see you dead than have you work less.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it turned into this huge riot. And this was not the only one. There were multiple riots in this instance where employers were like, I will kill you if you try and work fewer hours.
Right. This is a wild, it is wild to think about. This is the equivalent, the boss is going, no, you need to work all this. And the employee says, I can work 8 hours, or here's a hand grenade.
Yeah.
And that's essentially what happened.
Sadly, most of the people who died were the laborers too.
Of course. Because that's, you know, we won't get into power dynamics right now, but that's a whole different thing too. So now employers, like you said, would rather see their workers dead than well compensated. But in 1892, Massachusetts, again, the place without ours, reduced the work week to 52 hours for women. So there is kind of like a scaling back. You're starting to see kind of like a shaping thing going on here with these labor laws.
Yeah. Obviously sexist implications that
clearly,
yeah, they were meant to stay home and take care of the house more. So, I mean, even 52 hours a week, I feel like that's a tall order, but what are you going to do?
Right.
Now, the idea of a 6-day work week was fairly common in a lot of countries, particularly Western Christian countries is like a thing, right? Mm-hmm. And because seventh day, church day, no work, right? Okay.
Yes, of course.
Good. All right. In 1908, one employer in New England reduced the work week from 6 days to 5 days to allow their Jewish employees to observe their religious traditions.
Yeah.
And this was groundbreaking that they would do such a thing. But yeah, so that this shift has already brought us down from the 100 hours a week to we're now locked in for 10 hours a week or 8 hours for, you know, most of the government at this point. And now we're even down to a 5 Monday through Friday type work week so that Jewish families can celebrate their religious traditions.
I love that, actually. Like, that is a cool little thing. I had no idea that's what Saturdays were for.
Now, before we move on, we have like the craziest, most unlikely hero of the work week story coming up.
Uh-huh.
We are contractually obligated to take a break from this podcast because the government says that we have to. So we'll see you in 15 minutes.
Sounds good.
It'll be like 2. All right. So who was this mysterious person that gave us an appropriate work week length or appropriate, a different more kinder work week, work life balance?
Yeah, that would be the one and only Henry Ford of all people.
What?
Not generally considered a hero for many reasons, whose name has now among mechanics that work out there. Ford stands for found on road dead or fixed or repaired daily or something like that. Dude, if for those of you who are anti-Ford, more Chevy people, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I know it's a very specific thing. I don't know why I know that. But Henry Ford, the unlikely hero, and his son, Edsel Ford, actually led the charge in changing work conditions. Ford was interested in work efficiency and used data to make decisions about work weeks. What?
There's a thought. Yeah.
Wild.
And so he did some very radical things. One of the things that he did is he more than doubled the wage of his employees. They were making $2.34. That was essentially the industry standard for any worker who was doing this kind of like assembly line work type stuff. Mm-hmm. He increased that all the way up to $5 per hour. This absolutely rocked the automotive and other industrial companies to like their core. They were like, what is this lunatic doing? He is going to kill the American dream.
Yeah.
What a terrible person. It was a really huge change up to see compensation increase that substantially the way that it did, as quickly as it did.
I would also like to point out that that double in standard for the hourly wage, it's still more than many food service workers work on an hourly wage.
That's a fact.
Which is wild to think about. This was over 100 years ago when this happened.
Yeah, exactly. we're talking about more than a century past. And while the change in the cost of living has skyrocketed so far past what it was at this time that it's comical, and some people make less money than they did back then.
Uh-huh. Yes. I would like to just, again, tangentially capitalistic discussion here.
Yeah.
Now, the immediate payoff for Henry Ford and for his folks was loyal, hardworking employees who stayed with a job for longer. They promoted the image of the company as creating the opportunity for the real American dream and as a family-friendly company. And it was a gamble of this type of investment that paid off hugely for him. Like, it worked out for them quite a bit. And even people who didn't work for or know anyone who worked for Ford saw their efforts as very positive. So, like, people that weren't even related to this organization were seeing that this was, like, this had a positive effect. This had a good effect on the work industry.
Yeah, this sort of became a symbol immediately of like American success is the mm-hmm. Ford Motor Company at this part of the century.
Yeah.
At that time. Obviously, things maybe changed a little bit, but at the time, really well received. Now, in addition to that, Ford reduced the 6-day work week to a 5-day work week in 1922. Edsel, as I mentioned, his son, who is then president of the company, stated in defense of that decision that, quote, every man needs more than one day a week for rest and recreation. The Ford company always has sought to promote an ideal home for its employees. We believe that in order to live properly, every man should have more time to spend with his family, end quote. Their motives were not so pure as all of that, as we'll see in a moment. And also, pardon the language, I didn't write this. This is literally 100 years ago.
Yeah.
But you can see, I think, how they saw the benefit of what they were doing, not just financially.
Right. Absolutely. Now, Ford found that more than 40 hours per week, you could get only a tiny increase in productivity that didn't last very long. So you had folks that were working 40 hours a week. It wasn't really producing any sort of major effects. They were finding that like people were kind of capping out around that 40 hour. And so thus the 40 hour work week and higher employee pay actually increased productivity and made employees happier. Shocking to think about, right? People have their needs met. They enjoy their work environment. They're not working too hard. Boom. You have a really good company to work for, or at least that seems like that. Productivity actually improves.
Yeah. So this is actually the thing that I think is always worth pointing out. One, this essentially seems to be where it started. I tried to look around and I could not find anywhere else. Like Ford seems to be the first place that declared 40-hour work weeks, mm-hmm. which is interesting. Two, as you point out, and this is, I think, really important, is that they're like, okay, when we have people work more, we're paying them the same per hour for fractions of percentages of increase in actual productivity, right?
Right.
They're like, if we actually stop having them work beyond 40 hours, we don't have to pay them for the time that they're doing the extra work, and we're hitting about the same level of productivity.
Right.
So they're like, it makes the most sense to only ask them to work up until the point where they're continuing to be productive, mm-hmm. or else we're basically hemorrhaging money on the lack of return on investment.
Yes.
While the effect was happier employees and a better work-life balance for them and a better quality of life for them. The benefit was also for the Ford Motor Company, a way to become much more profitable by cutting down cost and maintaining a similar level of productivity. Just as a consideration for all those companies out there.
And this, that concept is going to come back around. Like, we are going to talk about that again in today's age and what that looks like, because we live in a world where there are many more technological advances, and it makes it so that our productivity is at a much different rate or a higher rate, or can be. And we may not need to work as much.
Right.
Spoiler alert. So we'll get into that, though.
We are getting to that. Yes. But we have a little bit of history to finish up here. One is that as the U.S. began to slip into the Great Depression, so we're sort of in the mid-1920s here, one strategy to avoid laying off workers was to shorten the work week to 30 hours. So they were essentially just paying them a smaller salary. And then it passed in the Senate, but before this, so this almost became national law, was a 30-hour work week, almost.
Yeah.
Because as I said, it made it through Senate, but before the House could pass it, an opposition party decided that they were going to get on this and try and shut it down. And all they had to do was say the magic words, which is
communist.
Yeah. As soon as you called something communist, it was basically thrown out. So they called it a communist agenda, and this elicited backlash against the bill, and Roosevelt abandoned it. But before those lobbyists got on their buzzwords, which, I mean, they're still using the same tricks today.
I was going to say, it's like, isn't it nice that things don't change?
Yeah, like that's that same type of approach. Still, you just call it socialist and everyone starts burning things and going crazy.
Yeah.
And so, like, that's all it took. That's all it'll ever take, is that little approach. So it killed the bill. Otherwise, we might have a 30-hour work week.
Oh, man, we were so close.
I know.
In 1938, the U.S. passes the Fair Labor Standards Act, which limited the work week to 44 hours for regular full-time pay. And if employees went over 44 hours, employers were required to pay time and a half, or what we call overtime pay. So that's what overtime is. And there are different layers to that, too. Like, there's double overtime and stuff. There's, like, you know, there's all kinds of different pay differentials and stuff. Now, this was amended to a 40-hour work week 2 years later. So in 1940, it became a 40-hour work week. So this year it turns 82 years old. So it's been for 82 years, we've been, I don't want to say celebrating, but we've been practicing this 40 hour work week pretty consistently.
Enjoying, maybe.
Enjoying.
Is that the word we're looking for?
Participating.
Yeah. Experiencing.
Experiencing. That's probably what it is.
Yeah.
Dealing with.
Yeah.
It's like coping.
Dealing with getting a root canal. So similar experience. Yeah.
Tolerating it.
So that brings us up to speed. We're essentially up to date. We've got a 40-hour work week that was passed in 1940. It has been that way ever since. That was the first time, essentially, that the government put that into place, that essentially meant past 40 hours, you are paying your employees overtime. Mm-hmm. So if they can claim a 40-hour work week, then they have to be paid accordingly.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about this 40-hour work week, though, and how it impacts us. Like, how does this impact us on a psychological level? Because that's what we do here at Why We Do What We Do.
Yeah, that's what we do and why we do it and how we do it and all that sorts of thing. So this idea of the 40-hour work week, as we all know, has essentially become it's an institutionalized norm. It is how things go. It's been more than 80 years of standard practice. And so we think of a work week as 40 hours because that has not changed. And it was kind of changing rapidly before that. As we saw, it was like every 5 to 7 years, sometimes a little less, sometimes a little more, there would be a change in the rules around labor practices, some of them national, some of them regional, all of them making headlines. Mm-hmm. But then we locked in on 40-hour work week and we just ended there. And so that just became how we think of a work week.
And I think as you kind of enter the rest of this discussion, one thing that we would impart on everybody is to remember that the most dangerous thing that you could say is we've always done it that way, because things do change, right? And so we're going to kind of talk about where this has led up to. Now, the first thing to note when we think of that 40-hour work week is it started in part because it was more efficient and people were more productive. That was kind of the thing, right? Like, we saw that 40-hour work weeks were better for everybody involved.
Right.
The businesses were making more money. They weren't having to pay as much. The employees were better rested. I shouldn't say well rested. They were better rested because they weren't working 80 hours and they were making a living wage at the time.
Now, that's not to say, though, that there was not. The thing is, we stopped asking the question at 40 hours. Right. We sort of talked about, can we get away with paying people less in a 30-hour work week during the Depression? didn't end up necessarily, like some businesses adopted that practice, right? But that did not become the norm. And so the question stopped being asked, but that was not the final word. People have been interested in continuing to research the work week and what that means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, one question was asked by a Harris poll in 2014 among 2,028 adults. They asked basically how people spent their time during the work week. Regarding their primary work duties, what percentage of their time was spent doing those? 45%. So yeah, less than half the time, less than half the time that you're in your 40-hour work week, you're not even doing your regular work duties.
Yeah. 16% was spent on meetings and 14% spent on emails.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Those both seem too high and too low somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it's bizarre to think about.
Yeah.
12% was spent on admin tasks and 13% on interrupts or quote other tasks. So basically any sort of interruption basically pulls your attention away from the task that you're supposed to do. And then you're spending part of your work week dealing with that interrupted task.
Right. Now, no one is likely at 100% productivity, or the number is so low it may as well be zero unless you work at Amazon. Mm-hmm. And then you have to be at like 99%.
Yeah. It's a whole thing.
Peeing in bottles and that sort of thing.
Yeah. It's a whole thing. They're working on unionizing. That's the
word. You got it.
I see. I'm telling you, like we've been talking about this earlier. I've been having a hard time with like Y words lately, like getting real marble mouth with it. Now, as far as productivity goes, it's probably okay. Some research has shown that prolonged focus on a task starts to demonstrate some kind of dwindling attention and lower productivity on that task. So we did an episode on attention spans quite some time ago, but we have to kind of go back to this question of how much time do we stay focused?
A study from 2011 in the journal Cognition showed that in groups of workers that had two distractions during a 50-minute task, they had higher productivity than workers who worked on task the entire 50 minutes without a break. And I say that after I had been writing notes for this episode going into my second straight hour.
So productive. They're so efficient. And they're so clear.
And just lacking attention to detail at that point.
You know what it is, though? Like, I don't know about you. Like, I notice that I have to take like regular breaks in the middle of a task. Like, and that's, yeah. I think, probably why therapy is so difficult, because you can't really do that, right? Like, you're in it and you're like, that's why it's so draining on therapists. Because you have to be there. You don't really get a distraction.
That's the main thing here, is that thinking about people do better when they don't have to focus that long mm-hmm. on those types of tasks. Now, there are going to be things that you're going to focus on without breaking your attention when they have a lot of built-in like incentive and motivation. And I think of like, and people maybe even screaming this at their stereo, whatever they're listening to, is video games. Like people will sit down and they will not blink their eyes for like 4 hours while they're committed to like a video game. But what we're mostly talking about here is tasks that don't have a lot of inherent value. They're usually tasks that are either mundane or routine, or mm-hmm. they're not fun, or whatever the problem is. They're things that we know we have to do, and we are better at them when we take little breaks.
Yep, absolutely. Now, the thing is that 40 hours, when we talk about this work week, it might be the maximum that we're productive at, right? So working for 8-hour days, 5 days per week has had better outcomes than anything that exceeds it. And we know that right now, right? So as far as we can tell, anything beyond 40 hours is really not worth what you're doing, right? You got to be careful with that. Some studies have shown that going over that 40-hour limit results in an increase in mistakes, less productivity, and decreased health. So it's just at that point in time, it just gets real bad.
Yeah. Just there's no point in going over it.
Yeah.
But it's not all sunshine and rainbows with the magic 40-hour work week number. First, the world has changed. Mm-hmm. There's the nature of the beast.
That's a fact.
The way that we all work together, the way that things are interconnected. I think that the ongoing conflict and war in Ukraine, the recent pandemic, the monkeypox upcoming pandemic that we're all experiencing, all of that and all the future problems and climate change has shown like we're just in a very different world now, and it is changing rapidly, right? Mm-hmm. And as such, we not only choose to bring our work home with us, we're often expected to bring our homework with us. Mm-hmm. Accessing our email on our phones and having work be available online has essentially meant that on average, people have started working up to 7 extra hours per week for which they are not actually being paid. Mm-hmm. So essentially what happened with all these advances in technology, which we appreciate and like, I'm really happy exist, but it's also meant that we've crept way over that 40-hour work week again without anybody noticing. And now we're doing it for free.
Yeah. Fun little tip for everybody. If you have your work stuff on your phone and you are expected to have that on your phone, you can request that your organization pay for you a part of your phone bill and all that stuff. And if they don't, then you could say they pay me for the time that I'm doing this. And if they don't do that, then they're breaking labor laws. It becomes a whole thing. But also be careful with that because you might work in an at-will state and that can get you in trouble. So just you should look into that is all I'm saying.
Yes.
Now, the second thing that we talked about is when aggregating data regarding work hours and productivity, a new picture emerged. What did they find? They actually found that countries with the most hours worked were among the least productive as measured by GDP per work hour. The most productive country was Luxembourg. And how many hours per week do the people of Luxembourg work?
Just 29. Yeah.
29 hours.
I was looking at this and this was from a few years ago. And so I was kind of curious, has anything changed? I know some things in the world changed.
Yeah. Like
global disease.
Yeah, that's the thing that'll do it.
So I was curious, like, are there any updated numbers? And yeah, the new data shows that Colombia with the highest GDP per work hour, and also they do have the third highest hours worked. But there's a couple caveats to that. So as I said, like, essentially the original argument was, look, if we look at the most productive country, they're also among the least working hours country. And now Colombia has the third highest worked hours and one of the highest and has the highest GDP. But Germany was just barely behind the US in GDP per work hour. Mm-hmm. They were $105 compared to $106, despite having the fewest work hours of any country measured. They were sitting at just 26 hours per week.
That's wild.
They were up among the top highest GDP. So even though there was an example of a country with the most hours and one of the highest GDPs, there's also a country with among the highest GDPs with the fewest work hours. Mm-hmm. And alternatively, Mexico has consistently had the longest work week at 41 hours per week and mm-hmm. the third lowest GDP per hours worked. So it does actually seem like, although the trends shift around a little bit, you kind of have a peppering in. I think most conservatively, what these data tell us is that more hours worked does not mean higher GDP, not reliably right. enough to have that be your strategy. And there is some, I think, inference that could be made that fewer hours work does not mean less productivity.
Right.
And I think that that's another pretty easy conclusion that can be drawn from those data.
Right. And I think we're starting to see more of that, too, is kind of like where things are going, which we'll get into in a minute. Now, France is an interesting example of commitment to this, as they have adopted several government regulations around work requirements. Companies with more than 50 employees required to establish, quote, off-limits work hours, and companies are required to allow up to two-hour lunch breaks where people are not allowed to be at their desks or even stay at the office at all. They have to get out.
Yeah.
And I kind of like that.
Right. I also am kind of on board with it. So yeah, there's like, you are not allowed to work if you are not scheduled to work. You are not allowed to be in your office when you're supposed to be having a lunch hour.
Good.
And there are some people who are not a big fan of that, who they're like, this is the only way I'm going to get through my task list is to work through my lunch hour and that sort of thing. But I think most people are pretty okay with this.
Yeah.
And there's never going to be a policy where 100% of people are happy with how that policy goes.
Sure.
You can't have that. Not with a large enough society. Like, this doesn't work. So, all right. Another thing that many have pointed out in terms of understanding the work week is that part of the idea, we're going back 80 years right now into the 1940s, right? Part of the idea of the 40-hour work week or more, because that was a novel idea back then, mm-hmm. was the idea of what they call the quote-unquote silent partner.
Ooh, now, your quiet friend.
Your quiet friend. That's exactly right. This was the person who stayed home to take care of all other home obligations while one person worked. In the 1940s, the one person who was going to find a salaried position, they were male. The person who was not going to find a salaried position, they were female. Mm-hmm. So this was the platonic hetero marriage, essentially, or relationship, whatever it was, and where one person could sort of take on the work that needs to happen to have a home. And now the thing is that it has become increasingly common over time that both partners work, and the mm-hmm. amount of work that they're doing has been increasing, right? We've been working a lot, particularly, as we said, technology has allowed us to work even more than we would normally work because we take our work home with us.
Right.
We bring our work laptop and we are on our email and that sort of thing. And so essentially what's happened is that both people are working and they're full-time jobs and they're trying to then have work at home. Like they've got to do all their chores and do all their cleaning and take care of all their kids and all of the work that they're doing. And so then it ends up just turning right back into their 100-hour work week mm-hmm. again, because almost all of their waking hours are spent doing those things.
Yeah. It's essentially what it is, right? They come home from work, take on domestic work, feel super relatable. Both of us like have domiciles that we have to maintain. So it is quite a bit. In addition, employees all the way up to manager report increases in responsibilities or their obligations or work tasks, I should say, like increases in all of those things, right, while their wages and scheduled hours stay the same. Now, the thing about this is we you could see this, like this is very clear as far as inflation and like how jobs are working and salaries are not catching up to all that. It is happening very consistently. And that is a big discussion that's happening right now, at least today in the United States. It's a very big discussion and people are so mad that baristas, even at Starbucks, are unionizing. So this is happening a lot consistently, and it's been happening for decades. What this means for managers specifically is that people, or just employees in general, they feel constant and slowly increasing pressure to be increasingly more productive with limited hours or using hours outside of their availability. So right. Essentially, like for those of you who are listening and you feel like you have a to-do list that needs to get done and you don't have enough hours in the day, you are not alone in feeling that. Your goal, set up a behavioral goal where you learn to tolerate to-do lists. And that is one thing that once I learned how to do that, that was so nice. Cause I can just shut it off. I'm like, yeah, you know what? That'll get done on Monday when I'm at my desk, when I'm getting paid to do that. If I'm not getting paid to do that, I'm done doing that. It took a long time to get comfortable with that, but I finally did.
Good. I'm glad.
Yeah.
Let that serve as inspiration to others to take that on.
Yes.
All right. A 2020 study in the journal Social Science and Medicine gathered about 8,000 Australian employees and found that working 40 hours per week or more was associated with mental health issues for women. They reported that the reason for this was due to the added responsibility of the fact that these are women who either were then also required to go home and then do childcare and that sort of other domestic work, or they might have even been not in a relationship and they were having to do all that extra work themselves. Mm-hmm. Men could work up to about 47 hours a week before they started to experience similar mental health issues. But so they were just looking at those. And I'm realizing now that we overworked ourselves and worked right past our second ad break. And so we need to let the capitalists step in, and we're going to go hit the vending machine and Keurig. All right. So we've covered the history of the work week. We've talked about how this affects us, which is that we've seen that it results in mental health issues, that we don't see a lot of productivity, and that we don't even like the current system, and that it's continued to expand and drag us back into where it used to be anyway. Mm-hmm. So that sort of begs the question, where is the 40-hour work week going?
So, you know, real quick, before we get into that, I'm very concerned for our Australian folks, because not only do they have to like stress out about a 40-hour work week and they are having those concerns you brought up, they also have to deal with just the wildlife of Australia. I feel like so much of like there's domestic responsibilities and all that, but there's also like making sure that there's not the most venomous snake just hanging out in your refrigerator or something like that. I feel like that happens, like just like a snake squatter just moves into your house and you have to worry about the snake living in your house and you can't get it out, or just spiders everywhere. That place is a nightmare.
And they've got those things called, as I'm given to understand it, the white ibis, which they like to call bin chickens, because they're like pigeons here in the United States and that they are everywhere and they get into the trash and everything, except they're huge. They're like these gigantic prehistoric sized birds that are everywhere. And so that's another thing you'd look forward to in Australia.
There's a reason it's called the Lost Continent, or it was for a minute. I don't know if it's called the Lost Continent, but that place is terrifying. Everything I've read about it is terrifying. So thoughts and prayers, our Australian listeners. So where are things going as far as the work week goes? Now, into the 1960s, as inflation grows but wages remain stagnant, employment becomes difficult to track as people start working multiple jobs to make more money. I don't know if you've ever held two jobs at the same time. I have.
I've had four. I had four jobs at once at one point.
Yeah, I think I'm right there with you. Like, I think it's been four or five at the same time. Yeah. So now the gig economy, also called non-employer establishments, really started to take off in the mid 1990s. So you start seeing more people working multiple jobs just to kind of make ends meet.
And just in case, I don't know, I'm sure people know what this is, but this is actually a term that I feel like has gained a lot of traction in the last few years, particularly with like Uber and Lyft, as those things came mm-hmm. along. Gig economy essentially refers to working gigs rather than having like stable employment. You take on a job. DoorDash is an example of this, Postmates, Lyft, Uber, TaskRabbit. These are all examples of where like you work like a job and you get paid for that job. But that means that a lot of employers really like the idea of the gig economy because it takes an enormous amount of responsibility off of them.
Yeah.
And a lot of legislatures have made it so that it is very difficult for people who work gig jobs to have any kind of protections as workers as they might have if they were in an employer establishment rather than a non-employer establishment.
So I'd like to make a point about that. So like for those of you who work a career in behavior analysis or like work in like a helping profession and you might have a gig where you are doing therapy and you're doing that. But if any of you have worked in academia and you have not gotten a tenured position or you're working as a professor or you're not hired on full time, if you're working as an adjunct, that is absolutely gig economy. Like you have picked up a gig. You have picked up you're going to teach a course for a certain fee, right? And then you don't know if you're going to teach the next course because you don't have a contract that goes into the next course. You have a contract per course. And that happens in academia with people with terminal degrees. So this is prevalent everywhere, including in the academic world.
But that also means that like, not only are you not guaranteed that next job, but let's just assume that you have enough business that you know you are going to have that next job. That means that you're working full time and not getting any benefits because again, your employer is not, they're not obligated by the government to give you any, unless you're in California, the one place where they have past requirements that gig employees do have to receive at least like healthcare or something like that.
Yeah.
And honestly, the thing that's kind of funny about it is it just goes right back to, you know, 150 years ago, how employment worked. And it's like, didn't we learn our lesson from like how
that clearly went we back did not. Then?
So anyway,
we know we didn't. Nazis are back. It's a whole thing.
That's true. That's a really good point. All right. Anyway, what we were saying, we got off on gig economy, and I think for good reason. But what then has happened now is that people were easily working 50 or more hours per week without receiving any overtime. And again, that was because employers were not going to pay overtime. And they also didn't even want to often pay full time if they could, you know, have you part time, that sort of thing, because there was reductions in how much it would cost them to pay someone salary positions, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then people just take on multiple jobs. And then what they're doing is they're working a ton of hours, but they're not getting any real additional pay for the hours that they're putting in, and they're not getting any benefits for those, or at least their minimal benefits. Mm-hmm. So many are proposing alternatives to the 40-hour work week.
Which I love. Now, one suggestion is a 20% decrease in the hours, but wages stay the same and everything is streamlined to make work time as efficient as possible, which I think is really, I think that's nice, right? So, so you get paid the same wage, which would account for inflation and all that. It's super efficient, highly productive, but you get to work less.
Yeah. The idea being basically you pack in productivity into much smaller, like really tight units. So it's like when you're on, you are on. You're like, focus, go, 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 go. That means you get more time off. That's sort of the idea there.
Yeah.
Another one is called Roe. Nothing to do with Roe v. Wade, but see our abortion episodes if you'd like to check out information about that. But R-O-W-E, and this stands for results-only work environment. R-O-W-E, results-only work environment. And this is one in which, as you can kind of tell from the name, employees get a flat wage. They only work as much as is needed to produce expected outcomes. And essentially, this is the idea. This is kind of how some salary positions have worked historically. And this is actually, I have worked a job like this and I thrived in this situation. Yeah. It was wonderful. Yeah. So basically, they're like, we're going to give you $1,000 to accomplish this task. Whenever you finish it, that's kind of on you. You have the, you know, we need it done by this amount of time. But like, this is, you have this whole week, $1,000, get the task done. That's sort of the idea. The employers who have taken this on, the ones that have taken this on who have reported about this, they say that they have gained double digits in their productivity. Like we're talking enormous productivity gains. And it makes a lot of sense, right? As an employee, your incentive is get as much done as you possibly can, because then you can either go on to another task where you could potentially make the same amount of money, but you're doubling it, right? Because you're earning it for the same period of time, but you're just working a lot. Or, and what most people are doing is, as far as I know, I didn't actually check to see like what the percentages were.
Sure.
But what they'll do is they'll get their work done and then they're just receiving passive income while taking a break.
Mm-hmm.
And more power to them.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I mean, and that's really good for people who can work quickly. I would probably really thrive in a space like that where I can work pretty rapidly.
Yeah.
But not everybody, that's not for everybody, right? So that's like true. That's, it really, you really have to understand what your skill set is to do some of the stuff.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
Yeah. Now there's the 980, which is where employees get every other Friday off as a paid day off. That sounds cool. I'm good with that.
Yeah. So you do a 5-day week and then a 4-day week and then a 5-day week and then a 4-day week and your pay does not change.
Yeah. That'd be wonderful. Now there's also flex time. Flex time gives employees a ranging level of autonomy in determining their work schedules and telecommuting options. The place I work at does have some flex time, which is really cool. Mm-hmm. And what this does is it creates better work-life balance and avoids the stress of being away from your desk. Like if I need to step away, I need to go to a doctor's appointment, I can always just go do that and then come back to my desk and kind of catch up if I need to. But I don't have to ever worry about like having to be in a meeting at a particular time when I need to go pick up my kids from school or something like that.
Yeah. Another pro of this is that people that are employees can tailor their work obligations to their individual situations. Early risers can get their work done early. Late risers can start their work later. Mm-hmm. People can take breaks as they need. If you suddenly need to pick up your child from school or from daycare or whatever was going on, you could do that. Your schedule would afford it. If you suddenly need to like make an appointment or go take care of some thing that happens during normal business hours when mm-hmm. you need to like do things and then everything's closed afterward,
yeah,
you could do those. So those are two of the pros, but there is also a con.
So it can be a nightmare because there's all these other things, right? It's impossible to predict what kind of work tasks are coming in, what kind of life events happen. And so then what ends up happening is work may or may not be on. You may or may not be at work at any given time, right? It's very difficult to kind of like draw the line. And so what this does is also create scheduling conflicts when people are needed for certain activities at certain times. So like, hey, I might need you for this meeting, but you're never available during that time because of some life circumstance. So there are some cons with that. I would say the big con that I experienced was that I didn't set a boundary mm-hmm. with this. And so I would work all kinds of hours, like at random hours and answer the phone. And so like, to really strengthen this, you have to make sure that you can be flexible, but you have like a very strict kind of set of guidelines for like when you're off work. So you have to learn to protect your time if you do that.
It does seem like if you could do like a proportion of time as flex time, it seems like that would maybe be a good compromise there.
Yeah.
But we're not even through our options yet. We're just outlining some of the various strategies that people have taken on. And we've already listed so many. Like we have now talked about the 20% decrease in hours. We've talked about the results only work environment or row, the 980 where you alternate Fridays off and then flex time. Another one is the 4-day work week. And this is, again, something that was sort of introduced as a concept. I mean, it's actually been around for a while, but I think it was popularized during lockdown and during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And this is the idea of taking your work week and compressing it into 4 days. What this mostly means is 4 10-hour days. You're still doing mm-hmm. 40 hours per week. You're just doing them in fewer days. But that does mean 3-day weekends. So that's one of the benefits. This also means less commuting, which means less money spent on transportation costs and less pollution from driving or taking other transportation to work. And it also means less traffic. So essentially the prediction being that if we were to take on this idea of the 4-day work week where it's compressed, it would take like just thousands and thousands, if not like hundreds of thousands of cars off of the road every week. And it would change peak traffic times too. So you'd have less rush hour traffic as well.
Now, the thing with this is that the data already show that these long days, they show a decrease in productivity, right? So we talked about kind of like that max, that gap where it's like 40 hours, 8-hour days tends to be where the maximum is. So a 4-day work week at 10 hours shows a decrease in productivity. Long days are exhausting for employees, especially if you're doing like really tough work, manual labor type of things too. Like imagine 10 hours versus 8 hours, that extra 2 hours can really make a difference. This is going to further prohibit other life activities that would take place before or after work. So it does kind of like get in the way of some of those other things that you might need to do to make sure that you maintain the home or like take care of your kids or whatever it is that you've got going on after work.
Yeah. I mean, just as you said, those 2 hours make a really big difference. The difference in what you can do after work, if you got done at 5 versus getting done at 7, is enormous. Like mm-hmm. how many businesses close between 5 and 7,
right?
Or at 7, or maybe you get done at 6 and the difference is between 6 and 8. And it's like, if you were going to grab dinner, like your options basically become fast food at that point.
Yeah.
You know, or you plan to start making dinner at 8 o'clock and eat like 9 or 9:30. So like you can see the like that can be a enormously drastic difference in people's lives. So just a consideration, not to say that this is a bad idea, just a consideration. The last one we have here is a 32-hour work week. This is 4 8-hour days. And the idea here is that you actually get paid the 40 hour per week salary, but you work 8 hour days, right? This is not dissimilar from the whole 20% discount or reduction in time thing.
Yeah.
The pros to this are that this is likely to be more productive. You're likely to actually see a higher overall output per work hour in this system. People are almost certainly going to be a lot happier and people are going to manage their time better. Mm-hmm. That is a predicted outcome of this type of thing and has actually been seen in some places where they've tried it.
It also, like you said, people are happier here in those spaces and employees manage their time better, but it is difficult to get all your stuff done. I mean, you have eight less hours to do the tasks that are required for the job, which I mean, that shouldn't be the reason why you don't do this, I should say.
Yeah.
It's probably worth looking at like a job task analysis and figuring out like, okay, well, what's going on with this task that I can't get them done often. But also too, it's very difficult to accomplish in businesses that require customers. Customer service, sales, and other issues of availability make it difficult for customer-driven work to be accessible to customers if employees aren't available when they're needed. So it requires a little bit more planning on the organization's part to make sure that all of the customer, those gaps where customers would be accessing the service would be filled.
That makes that type of work nearly impossible to navigate if you were to do something like that. And you imagine as a person who's a consumer, who is like reliably goes to some store or restaurant or place that you are a customer, if they were to suddenly reduce their available hours by, you know, whatever chunk they were going to reduce to accommodate a 32-hour work week, how difficult, like you basically never be able to go to this place that you were a frequent consumer.
Yeah.
And so I definitely do understand that like this is, some of these systems are going to work better for some businesses than others. And you just have to factor in like what is afforded by the business that you're currently in to have that work.
100%.
All right. Now, as we have said, the experience of ads when listening to a podcast is the experience of like going to have your blood taken and they screw up three times and you end up getting stuck four different times with a needle in your arm. And nevertheless, it is the blood that is needed to keep the podcast going. So we're going to stick you four times with the needle so we can have these ads happen. They're clean. The needles have been sterilized, but we'll be right back. So some sort of closing take-home ideas about the 40-hour work week. I think one for me really is that it is interesting to see sort of the history of how this thing has come. The 40-hour work week essentially evolved from it is necessary to work to sustain our community to we are now essentially being shuffled into cages to work all the living hours of the day and that, and then scaled back to like you can actually also have a life and do your job. And that to me, I think, is both interesting and kind of revealing sort of why we're here and how we got here.
And one thing I really enjoyed about this episode was that there's no like kind of cookie cutter way that this works. I mean, ultimately the goal is not to have somebody clock in for 40 hours and that's it, right? The goal is ultimately for an organization, productivity, like they want employees to produce. And to ensure that that's happening, they should be looking at data. So thank you, Henry Ford, for looking at data to help drive this. But I do think there is kind of like a weird thing there where it's like kind of looking at and organizations understanding and using their data to make decisions to kind of cater to their employees and what their employees need.
Yes. I like the idea of essentially, you know, a business paying their employees very, very well. And honestly, I have, when I've learned of businesses that treated their employees well, I decided to patronize those businesses more.
Absolutely.
And when I've learned of businesses that treated their employees poorly, I have decided to frequent those establishments less. Mm-hmm. And so those are, I think, things to consider as these large businesses make these decisions that your consumers are also watching you in this space. And we do care about our fellow human beings. And so we're going to generally try and go places where we feel like we are approving of how those systems are run.
I think that's a great point. I think the last point I would make too, and we didn't really touch on this, so maybe this is kind of like a new info thing. Work from home has been a thing that's come up a lot in COVID.
Yeah, that's true.
And so far, there is nothing to suggest working from home is any less productive than working in an office. What they've actually found are two things, is that people working from home are sometimes less stressed. They might have some more mental health stress because they're not socializing as much and they don't cut themselves off from work. So that's kind of a thing that comes up. That's kind of a weird side effect. The other thing is that the people will slack off just as much at home as they would at the office. So like there's no difference in that too. There's another study that came out. So there's no difference from working from home or working at an office, truly, if the goal is productivity, and you can establish an environment where productivity is kind of the ultimate indicator that your employees are doing the job that you need them to do. That doesn't account for happiness and all that stuff, but I do like the idea of talking about work from home in that it's just not as people are all hung up on that. It's yeah. like, no, you can work from home and be just as effective.
Well, and ultimately you think about it, this is why I really like this whole idea of the results oriented work environment. Mm-hmm. For a lot of jobs that just is not how their model is set up to work. Like it has to be like you have to produce things at a particular pace that have to be available at a particular time, that sort of thing.
Sure.
But there are a lot of jobs out there where all you have to do is get your work tasks done. Like that's mm-hmm. all the company needs to be successful is that their employees do their work tasks. And like, you don't really need to be in an office if you were right. at home doing that sort of thing. And I actually know some people to whom this applies very specifically that like their job said, like, you cannot work from home because we don't think you'll be productive. Come back to the office. I'm like, there's no evidence that they won't be productive. And their job in particular is one in which they just need to churn out a certain thing. So it's sort of like, once this thing is done, you basically let us know that it's done. Like the company says, we need this by this time. And you're like, okay, great. They pay you for that. And then the thing is done on that time and they go yeah. on selling their product. And it's sort of
exactly.
like, why do they need to be in the office for that?
Right.
They didn't want to be. And they probably would have been more efficient with their time because they could have just like, they're like, you know what? I have a lot of stuff I need to get done today. I'm going to get up at 6 instead of 7. I'm going to start early. I'm going to be done by noon. And then I'm going to go do the things I need to get done. And then that way their work thing is done and they can go on and do their life tasks. Mm-hmm. The employer doesn't need to know that they didn't spend 8 hours in front of their computer and they shouldn't really care.
Right. Exactly. Nailed it.
All right. Well, I think there's lots of other things to say, sort of take homes, but this is an interesting one. I had a lot of fun. I really like these suggestions for future ways of orienting to our work. I hope that many, if not most of them, get adopted in some capacity in places where they make sense, mm-hmm. specifically where we're continuing to use data to make decisions about whether or not these systems are working. And we are oriented toward, are our employees thriving? Is the system supporting them as human beings?
Yep.
And I think if we do that, employers and consumers, we're going to be surprised at how effective of a world that actually is.
Absolutely. 100%.
All right. You have anything else to end on before we move on to some recommendations?
Nope. That works for me.
All right. I think it's time for us to sell some things.
Yes.
Recommendations. All right. I am recommending a little business in Sacramento. This is called the Burger Patch.
That sounds and wonderful.
It is. There are not words.
I want to describe this for everybody who's listening right now. Abraham stopped, closed his eyes, and daydreamed about this place in this moment. So like that tells me it very rarely does that happen, but when it does, yeah. you should pay attention to his words.
If you find your way to Sacramento, I don't know if they have other locations. Stumbled upon it while I was in Sacramento, California. It is totally plant-based place. It is sort of your general comfort, you know, vegan fast food type stuff, but it is like the highest quality, so many options, which is rare for a place like mm-hmm. this.
Yeah.
The employees there were like incredibly friendly and kind. I just absolutely love it. And like, we were joking. So we just happened to be there and we were joking the following day, like, should we drive back to Sacramento to go for dinner? It's only a few hours, you know, in the car one way. Yeah. Anyway, that's my recommendation is if you find yourself in Sacramento, go check out the Burger Patch. You will not be sad that you did.
I love that. I love that. Speaking of things that you should check out that you won't be sad that you did. I have recently, not too long ago, watched the Dune movie. So I did this backwards, which is beautiful, just absolutely beautiful and done so well.
Yeah.
I started reading the book. Have you read the Dune book?
Twice. I actually reread it in preparation for the movie coming out.
Okay, good. So I'm reading it for the first time. And let me just say that for folks that don't like science fiction, I think this is still a fairly good read to get into.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think that you need to like science fiction to like this story or like it's a game of politics. Like the whole story is a politics and assassinations and plots and stuff like that. But,
right.
but truly, it is one of the most beautifully written books I have yes. ever read. I mean, strip the story away and just read it for its prose because it is absolutely beautiful. Frank Herbert is an incredible writer. And I feel like Dune gets its credit, but I don't feel like he gets his credit as a writer. It is so incredibly written. The world that he built is just unbelievable. So yeah. Much detail, so much specificity. I mean, there's the kind of the common gripe of like, okay, well, so much of Dune is spent describing the kind of the ecology of Arrakis, you know, the Dune planet. But like, truly, you can read it and it's beautiful. It is absolutely beautifully written. So I strongly recommend. I'm not done with it yet. I'm in book three of Dune. It's called The Prophet in the original, the first story. Mm. So I'm in that section, and man, it is just unbelievable. I'm like so stoked. I mean, as a matter of fact, what I'll probably do later today after I finish my task is probably spend like another like 2 hours just like sitting and reading this book, because it's just so incredible.
There's a line from one of the Dune books, I'm forgetting which one, that I'm going to butcher, but just goes to give an example. And I've wanted to use this as like a something I say at some point during the day, but it was something like the shimmer off the sand promised the day's heat or something like that.
Yeah.
And like, that's just kind of how he writes, is this like really thoughtful, poetic, but it's like, it's not poetic in the sense it's like, what is that supposed to mean? Kind of like avant-garde poetry a lot of people are used to. It's just this like really... like, oh, I totally understand the metaphor that you're employing in this situation.
It's very
spiritual. Yeah. And yes, I absolutely love Dune. I think it's one of the best sci-fi books ever written. But as you said, it's actually more sort of like a drama thriller situated in a sci-fi context.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of action that takes place. You've got, you know, your heroes and your villains, but they're really complicated characters.
And he does a good job of not like talking to you like an idiot. Like, he's not like when you enter this world, it like he talks to you like you are expected to know this stuff without over explaining anything. Like, he's not going to be like, well, here's what a still suit is. A still suit does da 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 da. He's like, oh yeah, you got your still suits. It's what captures your body's moisture. So you lose a thimble full of water a day.
Yeah.
You know, you save your moisture because you need it in the desert, you know?
Yeah.
And just like kind of like all the discussion around water on Arrakis is really cool.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I feel like we could do a whole bonus episode on it. Anyway, my point is like, just please go read this because it is phenomenal. And for those of you who are watching the video, patrons, they can see this. I've got the six books that come in the series. Like, there's six Dune books. I've got them in my background right now because I'm like leaving them out. I'm not going to shelve them yet because I know I'm going to read them pretty rapidly.
All right, so that was our mini episode on Dune and the Burger Patch. If you would like to talk to us about Dune or your favorite vegan fast food place or your experiences with the work week, what you would like to have happen, what you've seen happen, where things work, where they don't work, and any piece of history that we may have missed or corrections you'd like to add or research that we didn't talk about that you'd like to throw in there, you should reach out to us. You can contact us at our email info@wwdpodcast.com. You can reach out to us on social media, on all the different platforms that are not the, you know, fascist hate speech platforms, but the other normal social media platforms were there. And we definitely like hearing from everybody. You can leave us a comment, a rating, and review wherever you listen to find podcasts, which is pretty much everywhere. You know, that's the thing that happens. You can also join us on Patreon. If you do that, you get bonus things. As Shane said, you get to watch us record these episodes. We recorded a bonus episode recently, which often entails talking about movies.
Yes.
Often Marvel, but you know, just general. But also I did one where I interviewed Shane, which was fun. We have our unedited episodes. You can listen to all the things that we decided to cut that we didn't feel like warranted you listening to them for reasons. You also could get our notes there's all kinds of bonuses. Join us on Patreon. It helps us out a lot. You get all kinds of bonus cookies. It's really fun. And the other thing that you can do is you can buy some merch. If you head over to our store, we've got all kinds of things for sale, and people who wear podcast merch are the coolest people. That's
true. I agree with you.
So that's the thing. And I think that's pretty much it. I just the people who have already joined us on Patreon, and they're the best. You know, they really help make this thing happen. That is Amanda, Brad, The Daily BA, Joshua, Justin, Justine, Kim, Kostia, Layla, Megan, Mike M, Mike T, Shauna, and Stephanie. Thank you all. You're amazing.
Yes. I would also like to send a huge congrats to Brad. Brad passed his board exam, so congratulations. Welcome to the BCBA world.
Fantastic. Very nice. All right, very good. And then, of course, I could not do this without my team of people. They are the linchpin that helps this machine run. That is Justin, Selena, Kyle, Alan, and then, of course, you, Shane, for recording with me.
Happy to be here.
All the putting up with me that you do.
So, likewise.
I think that is all that I have. Is there anything that I missed or anything you'd like to add?
Nope, I think that covers it.
All right, then this is Abraham.
And this is Shane.
We're out.
See ya.
You've been listening to Why We Do What We Do. You can learn more about this and other episodes by going to www.wwdpodcast.com. Thanks for listening, and we hope you have an awesome day.